Good morning. Today is Wednesday, January the 26th. Joining us this morning is Humboldt County Supervisor, Mr. Mike Wilson. Good morning.
Oh, my God. Is it morning already?
Yeah. You blinked, huh?
Oh. Good morning to you, Brian.
Oh.
We'll keep it going.
There you go. Are you ready for our... Why do we say that? I've even got an outdoorsy one for you.
That's good. I've only once gotten pretty close. So it had something to do with, pearls and oysters or something. But
okay.
All right. But beyond that, I'm usually grasping at straws.
All right. Well, that's not quite the phrase, but we're close to that. Why do we say smelling like a rose?
Because you would lay roses on dead people when they lay in, after they died in stasis, and so that, they don't smell so bad when you're doing last rites or whatever.
Yeah, that's pretty good for off the cuff. Smelling like a rose. Barnyard humor was probably born a few days after animals were first herded into a pen. Still going strong, this special brand of humor has been a favorite of many famous people, including Abraham Lincoln. Every rustic likes to pretend that no city slicker has sense enough to identify horse or cow markings. Wandering into a barnyard, a fellow who looks down his nose at rubes is likely to fall flat on his face in the manure pile. That outcome is central to many a barnyard story. But perhaps for the sake of variety, an occasional spinner of tall tales would use a different ending. In such a yarn, a person falls into a manure pile as usual, but emerges from it without a trace of any foul odor. That outcome is always described as a result of extraordinarily good luck, not skill or wisdom. So it isn't necessary to remember the one about a son of a president who was up to his neck in savings and loan scandals to realize that once in a while, someone in a scrape really does come up smelling like a rose. So,
okay.
A little ruralness. Yeah, that kind of was wandering a little bit, but yeah, okay. We don't go point to point around here too often anyway, so what the heck.
We'll play into the rural-urban conflict trope a little bit. Why not?
Yeah. We kind of do anyway, just living on the North Coast, don't we?
I'm a little country, you're a little rock and roll.
Yeah. fair enough. A little situation is going on that we're starting to hear a little bit more about on a regular basis. There's been some adjustments with parking and housing in Eureka. A couple of lots are being swapped and some changes are going on. But there's one that is a little bit more specific to your area. One of the things, as I understand, that supervisors get to go through is the opportunity to select committees that they want to serve on at the start of each year. And I understand that you're on the Transit Authority Board. Is that accurate?
Yep. I'm on the HTA, Humboldt Transit Authority. I've been on there for a few years now. I'm also on RCEA, the Redwood Coast Energy Authority, and I'm also now on HCOG, the Association of Governments. So, yeah.
So one of the discussions that I've been hearing a little bit more and more about is an intermodal transportation center located between 3rd and 4th, G and H. There's a half city block there that's now a parking facility that is being discussed as a likely facility that would have buses and cars and employees, and on the second and or third floor housing, taking, I don't know, somewhere in the neighborhood of about 80 parking spots out of commission in a commercial business district. What is the background behind this as far as what you're aware of from the transit authority's perspective?
Well, I mean, I don't know if it's come up in meetings specifically related to the transit authority, but I have, in conversation, have seen some of those concepts based on sort of regional planning considerations. And a lot of those considerations are related to moving folks really not just, within Eureka, but from Eureka to Arcata to McKinleyville, and then also Eureka to south as well to Fortuna and beyond. and sort of centralizing that concept where folks are coming in from the east side as well. And the idea is that if there is going to be more density of housing within the central parts of Eureka, then there needs to be some sort of more centralized and more efficient and effective transport. And so I think that's probably what that's related to. And it's not uncommon for cities of the size of Eureka to have a facility like that.
I don't think that there's a lot of question, Mike, that the need might be there, but to put it in the middle of a business area, either retail or service or visitor serving like Old Town is, you know, you got one end of Old Town that's got empty spot. You've got where the Transit Authority's current location is with some space right there in the neighborhood also that it could just expand. Why not take advantage of one of those options rather than this other? Or has the city shared this with the board?
As we're moving in general, and again, I'm speaking to sort of regional planning in general, I mean, if we're moving toward, you know, less individuals in vehicles, and especially we're seeing in the younger generation, and we're seeing especially when we're talking about expansions of Humboldt State University, and hopefully that resonates with growth in CR as well. You know, travel by your cars in general is just going to become more expensive and less convenient in general as it is. And so you're really going to need to figure out ways to get people where they want to be. And what we find is that when you make it convenient to get people, especially in transit-oriented spaces, to where people buy and sell goods in terms of downtowns, this is where it is, and goods and services in general, but it also really helps have people living in those spaces as well. So if you want people to come into those spaces to live, you need to make transit as convenient as possible. And so these transit centers generally fit into that category. I think I heard also they were talking about the potential for having some child care facilities in and around that space as well, so that people transiting to and from work would also have a place to bring the kiddos when they're doing that, because that's a big problem for us here in many places, is access to affordable and really well-located places for child care as well. So co-locating all these things is pretty common. Does it sometimes cost you a few parking spots in that? Sure, it does, but also in general, Eureka doesn't have a parking problem currently.
In my experience. We'll talk about it a little bit more when we come back. It's 8:19.
Hi there, and good evening, and welcome to the Jim Bohannon Show from Westwood One Radio. We're at 1-866-50-JIMBO, 1-866-505-4626. Weekdays at 7 p.m., it's the Jim Bohannon Show. I'm Jim Bohannon. Join me here on KINS.
Good morning, KINS, News and Information Time. It's 8:24. We're back talking shop this morning with Mike Wilson, discussing the concept, at this point, of having an intermodal facility in downtown Eureka. Mike, one of the challenges I think that's there is as businesses and as the community looks to try to have a healthier downtown with options that are viable, you still need to be able to be customer serving. And yeah, you know, even if you have a lot of residents upstairs, you still need to have space for those that are from outside of a half mile who aren't physically mobile enough to be able to walk or to bike to the various businesses. You know, you've got Barbara Groom's facility, Lost Coast Brewery, right there. And if there's no parking for that restaurant, You know, what chance of success does it have?
Well, the answer is yes. You do need parking, absolutely, for you know, in the mix. But the question is becoming more and more: do you need parking? Do we have a parking crisis, or do we have a housing crisis? And where does housing live? And does housing cause us to take up parking or not? And this is one of those questions. But if we put housing out into the, you know, out of these areas, then people will have to drive in, unless you have, you know, transit to these various places, which is pretty expensive to get to all those spaces. And then you end up filling all those parking spots with cars anyway. And so,
right. If you have a surface lot that is covered by the building, mm-hmm. then it's a neutral plus, possibly.
But again, we're getting into the ideas and concepts that, you know, if you bring folks in to live in those spaces, those are your customers too, right? And so restaurants do very well, and do, when there's people who live and can walk to those restaurants, that is very valuable to keeping those sorts of things alive, especially in the evening time. And so I would say it's a mix. It's not an absolute in any one
right.
direction. You just gotta start leaning one way or another. And in a time when we're having this housing crisis, from my perspective anyway, the policy should be leaning towards building housing in those spaces where what's called the 15-minute neighborhood, where you can walk to everything within 15 minutes for most people, most of your services. And in that space, you really actually reduce the need for parking as much as, you know, for a lot. And if you do that and you want to extend or be connected to things like Humboldt State University or CR or other things, then transit hubs are generally part of that mix.
And now, is the county
conceptually where that is.
Is the county going to be adopting that same philosophy when the expansion occurs with the jail and those parking spots are knocked out? Are you looking at having more public transit for the staff that is working there and maybe using the parking lot across the street for another purpose rather than for parking?
Right now in that area, I mean, parking during the daytime, I walk around there a lot. I can tell you, if you're somewhat of an able-bodied person, there's plenty of parking around there in the daytime. And we can definitely work on how to manage for that. And at night, there's parking. As I often have to say, when if your expectation is to park in front of a business, and in order to do business, then maybe maybe you want to have more business. It's not a good sign if you can park in front of the business all the time.
Right, right.
What that means is that there's no one in the business, and so you really got to manage for that. I will say that the county right now is doing a pilot program where we have, through HTA, are doing a pilot program for 6 months, where we are offering all of our employees free bus pass. Basically, they can use transit for free for the next 6 months, and we collect data from that to figure out, is this changing the patterns for employees? Is this, where are they using it? Where can we provide better service? And so that started 2 weeks ago, I think, and it turned, you know, there was a certain number of passes available, and we exceeded that. We actually had to extend the offer to offer more passes. It seems right now to be fairly popular. I'm hoping to see that we get some more ridership out of it. I'm not totally certain of that, but we'll figure out that data in, like I said, about 6 months. And we're hoping that we set an example, not just at the county, but I think some of the cities will be doing this too, is, you know, employers, maybe there should be an understanding that employers, you might want to consider this as a basic benefit to employees. So that's kind of how we're getting. That's where we're going to.
For those businesses that are potentially impacted by this change, are there any dollars set aside to help them relocate? Yeah, I'm thinking that, you know, some of the retailers that just flat out lose or the service and businesses that just flat out lose the potential to have customers for whatever reason. Is there any kind of relocation fees or anything set aside for those folks that find it that it's just they have to move and relocate?
I've not ever heard of anything quite like that, but I do know that people's expectations about where highways go and where parking lots go sometimes are not don't match what they think. They think a change might be fairly negative. And if you look at even in, say, Eureka versus other cities that move their highways sort of either out of town or away from their downtown, I mean, if you look even now in where the businesses have the hardest time is where is where the cars are running by there in the downtown. It's a bit tough. It's not friendly for people who want to shop and dine and those sorts of things to have the busy streets going right through there. And so there was always a thought that, you know, having a car near you meant that you do good business, and that's just not always the case.
Right. No, I'm thinking more of those that have customer base that are older or frail or elderly, that walking isn't an option.
Yeah, we will, but also, I mean, that doesn't mean that you don't have those options for specialized parking for people who have mobility needs. That's generally the last thing to be,
looked at.
It's the last thing that you would might trade out for the other benefits related to housing and other things.
Gotcha. Yeah. Okay. KINS, News and Information Time, it's 8:30.
Something big.
Okay, it's a nice ride.
It's going to happen.
Stand by playback.
And now,
live. Real Red Meat Radio.
I keep forgetting I'm president.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
And these kids who come, they become Americans before a lot of Americans become Americans.
Now, here's your host, Lars Larson.
Hey there, it's Lars Larson. Join me for the Lars Larson Show, weeknights 10 to midnight. Honestly provocative talk radio on KINS.
Good morning, KINS, News and Information Time. It's 8:35. We are back talking shop this morning with Humboldt County Supervisor Mike Wilson. Mike, some of the different challenges that are out there are really opportunities. You know, we've had challenges in trying to develop on the North Spit, we being, you know, the magnanimous everybody living in Humboldt County. And now there's a little bit of traction that's going on out there. That's got to be exciting news that there's some economic activity and it's moving along nicely.
Yeah, I mean, the latest thing was on Tuesday, our board, or I guess that was yesterday, and we've been losing track already.
Yeah.
Our board approved basically what was an amended coastal development plan update amendment that allowed for, or that will allow for, extension and hookups to, you know, a centralized sewer system for the peninsula, you know, for the municipality or municipal district out there that's newly created.
Now, that doesn't sound sexy, but boy, it really is a big deal.
Yeah, it's a pretty big deal. I mean, it will have impact to both the businesses out there as well as all the way out to Fairhaven, where it looks like it's somewhere between 60 and 100 lots will have the ability to connect to sewer, so they don't have these septic systems that weren't meeting the standards required to protect water quality out there. And so having that ability to connect to those things is great. There were some restrictions that the Coastal Commission put on to that, limiting certain uses such as accessory dwelling units and some other sort of in-home businesses and community spaces. And that's mostly based on the fact that those areas are in areas that are likely to be inundated by sea level rise, not likely they will one day, but the as well as the tsunami risk, and so it's trying to reduce that that risk, but also really allow for people to take take ownership of those risks. Because the state in general doesn't really want to promote development in places where they're going to have to then mitigate for that, or in the future, you know, be put in the position of having to rebuild things. So they really are pushing very hard to make sure that everyone is accounted for in that. You know, that they understand the risks involved.
So is that why they didn't allow the ADUs that is being so pushed forward in so many jurisdictions? Or is it just that there's a carrying capacity and they just didn't want to have that exceeded units?
It has more to do with limiting the amount of structures and humans at risk. That's really what it is. While allowing for some development, some entitlements that have already been out there. So it's just trying to find a balance between those two things. Because ordinarily, if you didn't have any subdivision or housing out in those spaces now, probably no one would consider that a great idea currently. But it does exist. People do have investments out there. So what, looking for that balance between those two considerations.
So there is recognition that those folks do have that as an option. They just don't want to encourage it too much.
Right, exactly. So really, it's like if the residential development that is within 300 feet of the of where the lines are proposed to be will be required to hook up to those lines.
Oh, okay. And it makes it easier for them, too, because then they're not having to worry about septic.
Yep. Yeah, well, that's the point.
Yeah. I figured that was in there somewhere.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's important. I mean, it is kind of a detail, which is important to those folks that are out there, in Fairhaven. But more than that, it really, or in addition to that, it's really hooking up also a bunch of other businesses that are limited in their ability to do what they need to do. So it's going to be an overall very positive thing. The Harbor District is very supportive. The Samoa Township is supportive, and so it's a good.
That's what I was going to ask. Is this something that will help the Danco DeVries project that's out there to either pick up speed or for the town of Samoa to be broken up into individual parcels rather than the old company town model?
Yeah, I don't know the details of where they're at on all that currently, but I can't imagine it would hurt. It seems like it would be a net positive.
Well, that's what we're looking for, right?
Yeah.
Net positives.
Exactly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, net positive. I think we'll see some real benefits out there, some new investment, and again, in balance with the acknowledgement of the risk associated with what's there, with sea level rise, tsunami, those sorts of things. There are some areas out there that are higher than you might imagine or that you would think they are. But there are some pretty low-lying areas there, too, that we need to account for.
KINS, News and Information Time, it's 8:43.
Hi, folks. Fly Humboldt wants to remind you that flying local is buying local. And with four airlines going to seven cities serving hundreds of destinations, it's easier than ever to get to where you want to go from Humboldt County's airport. That's right, you can fly on AHA, American, Avelo, and United Airlines nonstop to Denver, Hollywood Burbank, Los Angeles, San Francisco, Reno, and Las Vegas. Flying has never been more convenient or affordable, so book your trip now. For more information, go to flyhumboldt.org.
Good morning, KINS. News and Information Time, it's 8:47. We're back talking shop this morning with Supervisor Wilson for another couple of minutes here. Mike, we've been hearing a little bit out of the state that there's a change that's afoot with solar panels, that the buyback compensation level isn't going to be nearly what it was, that the subsidized efforts to encourage more solar panels is either going to be reduced significantly or pulled back. What are you hearing about that?
Yeah, there definitely is some concerns about those programs that subsidize not just the installation of solar panels on housing or houses, individual housing and businesses, but really the buyback of the energy as well. And it kind of comes from two places. One, the concern is who subsidizes that and who has access to that subsidy. And so the concern is it has an equity issue in that in order to take advantage of that in general, you have to be a property owner. You have to have some means. And then who's subsidizing that are other ratepayers that don't necessarily have access to that. So the ratepayers that don't have access to that ability because maybe they're renting or maybe they're living in an apartment complex or whatever it is, there's not that access, then there's a feeling by some that there's an inequity in terms of who pays for it and who gets the benefit. And the benefit is homeowners and others who have, capital wealth, right, that are being subsidized. And so there's a real concern, and that, by demographics can play out in terms of how we talk about, racial equity and those sorts of things. So definitely that's the conversation that's being had about that. And it's one piece of it. The other piece of it is, where do we invest our dollars and how efficient is it in actually getting renewable energy? So we can invest a lot in individual houses having, power sources with relation to solar. But what's the difference between that and maybe a sort of larger land-based solar or other renewable energy project in terms of how many kilowatts can you get per dollar? And so there are some that would argue that the investments would be better made in sort of the larger facilities in terms of what your kilowatts might be. I think there's definitely nuance to that on both sides and of this discussion, and especially if we're just trying to get renewable energy in the field and built and done. And the program has definitely done a wonderful job so far of really advancing solar technology and neighborhood resiliency, which I think is would be one of the arguments for keeping it, which is basically localized power. But it's especially becoming important as we are integrating battery systems into this, and I think that's going to become part of that conversation too, because as we are able to have individual battery systems in our businesses and homes, we're able to actually hook into the grid and actually become power suppliers to the grid on off times as well. So I think that's going to be very interesting part of the conversation.
None of the arguments are changed. The buyback, the fact that it's homeowners or property owners, okay, those haven't changed. The determination to use this for the residential side instead of maybe municipalities or large solar fields, that hasn't changed. Is it just an interpretation, or is it like PG&E? Well, one of the thoughts that has been I've seen that was speculated is they weren't able to get as strong an ROI when they're having to buy back this energy at a lower level than what they would be able to realize in purchasing it, which seems to be something that would be more beneficial for those folks that couldn't afford or a house. They're in a rental situation. It would be keeping their utility costs down also. So am I missing something in that equation, or is it just a new interpretation at the state level of what they want to support culturally?
Well, I think it's really economically and who gains that benefit. And you're right. I mean, there's definitely that narrative or that discussion about who benefits. The numbers are pretty clear that people who don't have access to property ownership, and that is a pretty significant number of people in the in the state of California, there's a perception that there's some, you know, subsidy of people who do, and so
their utility bills aren't kept more rational at lower levels,
right,
because there is the buyback going on and PG&E isn't having to generate it. They're just able to pass it through. They're not realizing those savings also?
Right, exactly. Well, they're not, right, they're not realizing those savings, like, at the, right there. So it's like when, you know, as a homeowner, someone who has a solar system, and I don't have one, I sure would love one, and I, you know, it's definitely on my list of things to get to, but I certainly have friends who do, and they tell you, oh my God, my bill is only $4 a month, or whatever it is, right? And
Sign me up right now. Never mind.
Right, exactly. And so the subsidies of that create that benefit to them are not available to people who maybe don't have access to, you know, or are not the landowner and can't actually access that value. And so they're not getting those rate cuts directly to them. And so, or even the added capital value onto the home. So it's like,
right,
these programs,
right,
as these programs subsidize these values, it's like we're giving added value to the people who already have, and relative to the people
so
who have not.
It kind of sounds, you know, like it wasn't thought through at the state level 100% when they put the program in, or this was something that was acceptable.
Right. Well, that's, you know, put that on the negative side, and then there's the positive side about the resilience within the community and all of those things. And so, they're just gonna have to find the balance, and that's the discussion that's happening. I don't think it's gonna be personally. I don't think it's gonna be a complete wipeout of the subsidy, but
some adjustments.
I think there'll be some changes for sure. I imagine.
All righty, bud. Hey, thanks. It was fun talking.
Talk to you later.